Go ahead and turn to Isaiah chapter 41. That's where we'll begin this morning. If you were here last week, you know we've started something brand new, even though we're in the same book that we were in before. Because in chapter 40, things switch dramatically. In chapter 40, they start over, and instead of talking about Assyria being the problem and their trust in God being the problem, he moves forward now to about 150 years after the lifetime of Isaiah. Chapter 40 spoke to a very discouraged group of people. They had gone from an immense false optimism to about as far into hopelessness as a person can go. You know, it's one thing to face a situation that drags you down, but when you've gone from this mountaintop of optimism to this very pit of pessimism and despair and hopelessness, that's a tough thing to rebound from. Somebody doesn't just walk in and say, well, let me pat you on the back, everything's going to be all right. And you perk right up and say, well, of course, what was I thinking? I feel a whole lot better. Now, you've had enough of those kind of experiences in life to know that it just doesn't work quite that way. So in chapter 40, God told him it was going to be all right, and he started out with the word comfort. Does he want to deliver them after all they've done? Resoundingly, yes. He has not forgotten them. But against the power of the nation that holds us captive in Babylon, what can God do? He lays it on the line. He can do anything he wants. But we're too tired to move on. That's when he tells us, don't worry, God doesn't get weary. He's the one who gives strength to the weary. Now that's all very encouraging, except for one thing. When you've fallen from the height they were at to the depth that they've fallen to, even though it's God saying everything's going to be all right, it's still hard to bounce back quickly, to put a good face on it, and to say, okay, it's all going to be fine. So they're going to need some help accepting what he just said. They need help climbing out of that pit in which they find themselves, and that's what chapters 41 through 48 are all about. God isn't one of those people who walks up and slaps you on the back and says, what are you so down about? Perk up, and then walks off grinning from ear to ear, and you're still sitting there saying, but that didn't really change anything. I've still got this problem to deal with. Instead, these chapters 41 through 48 are God hanging in there with them, helping them to see what they need to see in order to climb out of this pit that they're in. These chapters help them to see that what God's saying to them is far deeper than someone just slapping them on the back and saying it's going to be all right. God is helping them come to grips with the things they need to know to climb out of that pit. How is God going to work all that out? Well, he's going to say three very important things to them in these eight chapters. First of all, he's going to say, God is Lord. They need to understand that because it looks to them like Babylon has all the power. It looks to them like Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon hold all the cards, and they aren't inclined to let the Jews go back home. And here God is saying, you're going to be heading back home. How is all that going to work out? Well, God is going to show them that Babylon is not even in the game. Then he's going to tell them, number two, God is rescuer, the idols are not. It may seem like Babylon's gods are more powerful than anybody else's gods. After all, isn't Babylon's power supreme in the world? And so God makes it clear he is the rescuer, not the idols. Idols have never rescued anyone. God, on the other hand, has a long history as a rescuer. And when he talks, therefore, pay attention. Finally, he's just going to say to them straight out, quit being stubborn and listen. Sometimes that kind of brutal honesty is a breath of fresh air. We're prone to give excuses for not listening to God, and all of us have done that. Rarely did any of us admit what the problem is. We're just too stubborn to want to listen to God, and we need to face up to it and deal with it. So Isaiah points that finger at them very directly. So let's see how God helps them climb out of this pit. So he says, God is Lord. But more than that, Israel is his servant. Now, if those two things are true, that puts this whole thing of being captives in Babylon in a different light. We pretty much, in their situation, have to either accept God as Lord and what he says will happen, or Nebuchadnezzar is Lord and what he wants will happen. If we accept God as Lord, then things look very, very different. On top of that, if God is Lord and Israel is God's servant, then maybe they can climb out of this pit. So let's see how he helps them come to grips with that. He begins in verse 1 with a challenge to the nations. All right, you think you're strong? You think you can challenge me? Come forward and speak. Meet me in the place of judgment, the courtroom, and we'll look at the evidence and see who's God and who's not. Now, how is God going to show the nations that he's Lord? He's going to do it in a way we'd never suspect. The nations are all silent in anticipation, and he asks a simple question. Who has stirred up one from the east, calling him in righteousness into his service? Who has handed the nations over to this man? Who has caused the kings to fall down before them? Now that has to raise a lot of eyebrows. One from the east? God doesn't give Israel all the information he can here. He'll do that later. Right now, he just whets their appetite. Babylon stands in the way of the Jews returning home. They seem invincible, but now, suddenly, God raises doubts about Babylon's invincibility. Who is this one before whom all the nations fall? Could there really be hope of climbing out of this pit of hopelessness? Could it be that someone could destroy Babylon? God goes on. Someone very powerful has called the man from the east into his service. Someone very powerful hands nations over to him and subdues kings before him. Someone causes him to move through all this opposition unscathed. Who do you suppose might raise up someone like that? Who controls generations to bring that to happen, even 150 years after Isaiah talks about it? God says, I won't keep you in suspense anymore. I'm the one. All that gives us pause. He doesn't tell us yet who this one from the east is, but he's already talking about it as if it has already happened. God must be fairly sure of himself and of his control in history to go on record talking about this long before the event ever happened. All the nations are standing here in the courtroom. God says, I'm the one doing this. Does anyone else want to step forward and tell me that you can call a man to be your servant and give him power to subdue kings over 100 years before he's even born? God says, I did it. Do you need any other proof that the nations are under my control? I chose this man. I gave him victory over all the nations. Now, what are you going to do about that? Tell me if you can. I am the Lord with all generations, from the very first to the very last. When I get ready to send you to home, I'm not going to be sitting there worrying about the power of Babylon. I'll just whistle for this king from the east to come running, and he'll take care of Babylon for me. I won't even have to get my hands dirty doing that. He's not here yet, but I've already set this chain of events in motion, so we might as well talk about it as if it were already a fact. Do you think Judah won't go home when I get ready to send them home? God is very plain in verse 4. He knows the generations from the beginning. He doesn't have to wait to find out what's going to happen in history. He's the one who puts it in motion before it ever begins. Now, what's the nation's response? Verse 5 doesn't leave any doubt. They cower before God. They're afraid. If one this powerful is going to come from the east, they had better get ready. We're not sure our old idols are up to protecting us from this. We need to build bigger and better ones. Perhaps if we encourage each other enough, we can. The goldsmith says to the craftsman, "Be strong, hang in there." The craftsman says to the goldsmith, "That's a great god you're making there on that anvil. Keep it up. We'll have a better god than we've ever had before." And then when it's done, they say, "Well, actually, not too sturdy, is it? Maybe we better put some nails to keep it in place so it won't topple over." So how does God help Israel climb out of this hole? First, he says, "I've raised up someone from the east who could conquer any nation. And I did that long before he was born. All the nations could do is try to respond with the better idol. And then the best effort they can make is you have to nail it up to keep it from toppling over. Doesn't give you much confidence in it, does it? Given all that, when I tell you, you're going home from Babylon, do you think the power that Babylon seems to have today is anything that I ought to worry about or that you should worry about? All the nations can do is build the kind of gods they've always built, and they can't even stand up on their own without help. Why would you ever doubt when you're down in the pit of hopelessness and despair? Why would you ever doubt that God can bring you hope and comfort? The nations can't even respond to God's lordship. Their best effort is completely pathetic." And now he's going to make his second point. "Don't fear, because I chose you as a servant." If the nations can't respond to God's lordship, then Israel, where does that leave you? God is going to say something incredible to this worthless vineyard. "There's a second reason you don't need to be afraid. You are my chosen servant." Yep, that's right. Don't go looking for somebody else. You're the one I'm talking about. You, the children of my friend Abraham. See, God says Abraham was my friend. And I told him, therefore, that by his descendants, all nations of the earth would be blessed. Now he turns to Israel and says, "Let me give you a one question pop quiz. Whose children are you?" Well, no fair peeking at your birth certificate. You're children of Abraham. You're the ones that I promised my friend Abraham that I would bless the whole world through. Now that makes you my servant. Now if the nations can't refute my lordship, do you think you as my servant have anything to be afraid of? So don't fear. Don't be dismayed. If you're my servant, that means I'm your God and I'm in charge, so I'm going to strengthen you. I'm going to uphold you because I've got a purpose for you. Your future is in my hand because that's where I hold you. The fact that you went into captivity was from God, and the fact that you were brought out of captivity was from God. So don't be afraid. God hasn't abandoned you. Now, if Israel is God's chosen servant, how's all that going to work out? Verses 11 through 16 explain this. During the time when Nebuchadnezzar took Jerusalem, things looked very bleak. People went hungry, people died, people were taken away from homes that they loved. They were forced to a strange land. They wept for Jerusalem. But God says that's not all the story. Before the story ends, verse 12, no matter how you search for your enemies, they're nowhere to be found. You won't eventually come out of captivity because you're lucky. You'll come out of captivity because God intends for that to be the case, and therefore that's what's going to happen. Now how do they see themselves? Verse 14. Like a worm. Foreign powers despise them. And when other people despise you, before long you begin to despise yourself. Babylon conquered us. We're slaves. We're not much better than worms. They've been that way before. Remember in the wilderness after the spies went into the land, they saw themselves as grasshoppers. But he said, you don't have to worry. God is your redeemer. So verses 15 and 16 tell us that this worm will metamorphose into a threshing sledge that will scatter the nations. The gods of the nations won't be able to do anything for them. But Israel will look at their God and they'll recognize he is the Holy One of Israel. A chosen servant. Can that really be the case? If we're going to try to tell a group that's downcast and discouraged and disillusioned that good news is coming, how would you go about it? Isaiah says, we'll show you a huge contrast. Things are going to be completely the opposite of the way that they seem now. Right now, you feel like you're parched with thirst and there's no water to be found. God is going to answer you and open up rivers and springs and even a pool of water in the wilderness and even fountains of water in a dry land. Why choose Israel as servants and reverse the situation so that it can be like springs of water in the middle of a desert? Verse 20 says, it's so people can know and see who He is. You see, the return from Babylon was not a simple historical event. It was a clear demonstration of God's power in the world. What other God had ever sent His people home from captivity? None. What other God has ever done anything like that in the history of the world? God is unique because He has the power to change the course of history. And He makes that point several times in this section. And now His third point is going to be to turn around and challenge the idols. God has made two points to show Judah they can have hope. He challenged the nations to refute His lordship, and all they could muster was this pathetic response to build another idol. And it even had to be propped up so it wouldn't fall. Then He told them He had not abandoned them, that they were His chosen servant, and He had a purpose for them. Yet God knows that throughout their history, Israel has trusted in idols rather than in Himself. When you attended Sunday school class as a child, you heard about the great faith of David and Samuel and the goodness of Hezekiah, and you probably came away thinking that, well, for the most part, God's people were pretty faithful. But read Kings and Chronicles and the prophets, and you'll find out just the opposite was true. More often than not, they trusted in idols more than they trusted in God. Now, if they're going to climb out of this pit and get back on track, they have to change that. And therefore, we have a picture of a great gathering. And God is there, and so is Israel and all the nations. And so He just turns to the nations. He says, okay, make your case. Make your case. If you're going to serve idols, then show us how that's justified. So He gives three challenges. Challenge number one, tell us what will happen in the future. In verse 22, He says, make a prediction about the future. Tell us what's going to happen. Surely if you're a powerful God, you'd be able to do something like that. The nations look at you as though you're more than a stick or more than a stone carving. Okay, if you're more than that, then go ahead. Make a prediction. Tell us what the future will bring. The idols just sit there and don't say anything. They can't. So then He says, okay, well, let me give you another challenge. Tell us what history really means. As for the former events, verse 22, declare what they were. In other words, if you're really a God, then look back on history and interpret it so that we can see its underlying purpose, so that we can see where it's headed. Tell us what history is really all about. If you're a God, you ought to know the purpose of history, so tell us that. Challenge number three, in verse 23, intervene in the world. Do something. He turns to the idols and says, bring a blessing on somebody, if you can. Bring a calamity on somebody, if you can. Do good, do evil. Just do something to show us that you're more than a stick of wood and carving out of stone. Do good, do bad, do anything at all. Do something. Don't just sit there like a block of wood. Oh, I forgot. You are just a block of wood. Now, what's the outcome of all these three tests? Silence. The idols can't pass any of them. And so they're shown up for what they are, just blocks of wood or carvings out of stone. They can't do anything. He's standing in front of this great gathering of nations. And in one corner you have the Babylonians with Bel and Marduk. And off to the side you have the Phoenicians with Melkart and Baal. And the Egyptians are over here with Ra and Osiris. And God's issued these three challenges, and what do the idols do in response? Nothing. What can they do? Finally, he comes right out and says that you're of no account. Your works amount to nothing. The one who chooses you is an abomination. He's wanting his people to get the point. Now he's going to make his fourth point. All right. The nations might say our idols can't do anything, but God, okay, you've made this challenge. Can you pass the test? Show us that you're any different from all these idols we serve. Verse 25, God says, that's just fine. Don't mind if I do. God says, I've stirred up one from the north, and he's come. From the rising of the sun or the east, he'll call on my name. We'll see later there's good reason to say that this one is both from the east and from the north. But this one will tread down rulers like a potter treads out clay. So what has God just done? He's done exactly what he challenged the idols to do. First of all, he's predicted the future. This is what's going to happen. He challenged the idols to do that, and they couldn't. Now, this is significant because at the time Isaiah wrote this, Assyria was still the world power. Babylon wasn't even the major power in the world. Assyria was going to be overthrown by Babylon, and then Babylon would be overthrown by the Medes and the Persians under Cyrus. You see, he's looking ahead not just to the next great world power, but even to the great world power beyond that. And when the time comes, people will look back on this and say, only God could have told us all this will happen. He's right about the future. Secondly, he's showing them what history meant. The Jews in Babylon were tempted to believe, as the pagans did, that the nation that was victorious must be the nation that had the most powerful gods. Babylon won. It's the most powerful nation in the world. Therefore, aren't Bel and Nebo and Chemosh, maybe they're more powerful than Yahweh, Jehovah. After all, he couldn't keep the Jews in Jerusalem in their own country and give them victory. But by raising Cyrus up to restore the Jews back to their land, God makes it very clear, yes, I could have kept them there in the first place. They were not in Babylon because God was too weak to save them. They were in Babylon because they were this vineyard he talked about in chapter 5 that he'd done every other possible thing he could to work with, and finally that was all that was left. After he delivered them time and again, after he sent prophets to them, he said, well, this is what I have to do to work history the way I intended to work. So God is saying this is what history is all about. Third thing he's doing is acting in the world. He's doing something. He not only predicts that this ruler from the north and east is going to come, God is responsible for this ruler coming. See, history didn't just happen. The Medes and the Persians didn't just destroy Babylon because that's the way history worked out. God said that happened because that's exactly what I intended to have happen. He's responsible for it. He challenged the idols to do something. They couldn't do anything. God can and is. He's influencing the course of history. So God is meeting every one of these challenges he gave to the idols, predicting the future, explaining history, acting in history to do something. God says, I am the one who raised up this ruler. I'm the one who gave him success. And now he turns around and faces the nations with their idols and says, now who said ahead of time what will happen? Well, only Yahweh and him alone. The idols didn't speak to anyone. Babylon, Cush, Tyre, Sidon, they couldn't say, well, I already knew this great king was coming. You know, my idols already told me about this. Couldn't say that. Their idol hadn't told them a thing. Therefore, when God challenges the nations to speak in verse 28, no one can give an answer. Even the best wise men can't. They can't answer because the idols are worthless. Their images are wind and emptiness. You might ask this question, if the idols are worth nothing, what does God want for the nations? Does he want them to be without a message? Does he want them to be without comfort and hope? Well, the answer is found back in verse 8, Israel is my servant. And Israel had a responsibility and a mission to take that message of God to the nations. Now, his fifth point here then is God is going to use His chosen servant to bring light to the nations. Remember where we are. God is trying to help Israel realize that they can come out of this pit of hopelessness. God is trying to help them see that when He says He's going to send them back home to Jerusalem, they can trust Him because He is dependable. So God said, He is Lord, the nations are not. How can we be sure? Well, the best response the nations can come up with is an idol that can't even stand up on its own. Israel is His chosen servant. The idols can't respond to God's simple challenge, but God has met that challenge the idols couldn't, and now He's going to explain to them the whole purpose of history. He's going to tell them why He let His temple be destroyed in Jerusalem. There's a purpose God is working out in the world, and He wants them to know and understand it. And so the most amazing thing is this: His purpose for the world revolves around this servant whom He's chosen, these people that He's trying to help them climb out of this pit of hopelessness. With Israel and Babylon, you see, it sounds like the promise to Abraham has reached the end of the road. They're in Babylon and it appears like they're done for. Jerusalem's destroyed. The temple's wiped out. This promise that all nations are going to be blessed through the seed of Abraham doesn't look very much like it's going anywhere. It looks like God's plans have reached a big dead end. And in the big picture, we have to look and ask the question, with all this mess, how is God and the world going to bless all these nations? We have some very discouraged people in Babylon who feel like all hope is gone. And if we look at it honestly, it almost looks like that. They're captives in Babylon. There's not really a home for them to return to. The city's been destroyed. But then God says something very profound that we might miss if we're not careful. See, God says to Israel, I choose you, in 41 verse 8. In verse 24, God says to the idols, anyone who chooses you is detestable because you're less than nothing. There's a contrast here. An idol can't choose them. They have to choose it because an idol doesn't have any power whatever to choose. If an idol's involved, it can never be the chooser. It can only be the choosee. Okay, maybe the one chosen, but that didn't quite sound as good. I don't know. But you see, Marduk couldn't choose Babylon. Babylon had to choose him. God is the only one who can choose, and He chose Israel. That's powerful. Now, by this point, if you're in Babylon, you're so discouraged that you're probably saying, well, God may choose us, but there's nobody else left to choose. God says, no, let me explain who you are. You're not my last pick. You're not chosen like some of us were in grade school for the football teams because you're finally the last one left out here and, well, okay, I'll take him if you'll take him. God didn't choose them that way. The only one who can choose is God, and He says, I chose you because I delight in you. God says, I'm choosing you for a special position. What kind of position is that? A servant. Who does God uphold? Who does He choose? In whom does He delight? To whom does He give His Spirit? Isaiah says, a servant. He's not talking about the kings or His advisors. He's not talking about the richest man or the poorest man. He's talking about the person who will be a servant to Him. Now, why is that important? The servant has an objective, and that objective is to bring justice to the world. See, if you read verses 1 through 4, this word justice shows up 3 times in 4 verses. Now, where have we seen that word justice before in Isaiah? Well, justice and righteousness just keep showing up time and time again in the book of Isaiah. You can't read Isaiah without understanding that justice and righteousness are important to God. But who is Israel bringing justice to? Well, the nations. They haven't been practicing it much. We saw that back in all these prophecies against the nations in chapter 13 through 23. Well, why didn't Israel bring justice to all these nations before? Well, there was a problem. She wasn't practicing it herself. The rich people were taking advantage of the widows and orphans, and if the law didn't let them do that, they'd bend the law so that they could. Now, if Israel was behaving that way, how was she going to show justice to the nations? Israel couldn't show the nations what it was like to live under God's judgment until she was living under God's justice. And so justice is establishing God's rule on earth. It's bringing in a new system of things. It's the will of God being done on earth as it is in heaven. And that's what he's calling his servant to. Now, if you're in Babylon about this time, you might be thinking that you might like just to continue wallowing in your discouragement instead of being chosen as a servant to do this. This is unbelievable to them. Bring justice to Assyria who treated us so cruelly. Jonah had a little problem with that, didn't he? Bring justice to proud and cruel Babylon who carried us away into exile. Bring justice to kings like Sennacherib or Nebuchadnezzar. They're not really too interested in justice for these people. They just as soon see God destroy them and wipe them off the map. But this is important. God doesn't say he will bring justice to the nations. He will, but that's not his point here. He says his servant will bring justice to the nations. And so you can imagine a bunch of Israelites saying, "What, me bring justice to Babylon? These troops killed my brother and my parents, they raped my sister, and they called us all away into captivity, and you want me to bless them? No way." And yet God says, "No, that's what my servant does, is bring justice to people. My servant, my job as a servant is to do all I can so that everybody in the world knows who God is." See, that may play out in some ways we don't like. Who needs to know God more than Al-Qaeda? Who needs to see what it's like to live under the justice and blessing of God more than the Taliban? Now, I'm not making a statement on politics or national policy or anything like that. That's not the point. The point is God is making a statement on here's what my servants are all about. They're about helping people understand and see what it's like to live under the reign of God. Now, I don't for a minute believe everybody should work in a foreign mission field. I know we all have different gifts. But if I don't care in some way about the rest of the world, even about the most unlovable parts of the world, so that they can see what it's like to live under God's justice and righteousness, then I seriously need to ask myself, am I being God's servant? Well, if you're going to establish the kingdom of God on earth and bring justice, you better have a strong army, right? You need a strong nation to bring that about. You need a strong leader, one that's charismatic, one that's not weak and feeble. No, God says, he's not going to entrust this to some strong nation. He's going to entrust it to his servant, who happens at that moment to be captives in Babylon trying to dig themselves out of this pit of hopelessness. How will his servant go about that? Well, we could lay down plans, noisy propaganda, newspaper headlines, high-pressure manipulation, bullying. No, that's not going to be the way his servant goes about his business or the way he gets the job done. He says he won't cry out or raise his voice in the street. That won't be his method. But what's going to sustain him is God's Spirit. And so he's going to tell us a lot about his method. He's not going to break a bruised reed. He won't snuff out this dimly smoldering wick. Sometimes they would use reeds for staffs. How do you use a reed for a staff in the first place? Well, kind of carefully. A reed is not really strong to begin with and won't hold a lot of weight. Now you find a bruised reed, how much weight do you think it's going to hold? Not much at all. But you see, that's the way God's servant is going to get his message through to people. He won't tell people about God by crying aloud in the streets and by being obnoxious to people. He won't do it by trying to give them heavy burdens to carry. He'll stop when he reaches a point that's more than people can bear right now. You see, what happens to a bruised reed? He's using two metaphors here to help us understand this, the reed and the flax. He's not going to break this bruised reed. He's not going to run roughshod over people. He's not going to get irritated or disgusted or begin despising people. If you have a bruised reed, what do most people do with it at that time? Well, they break it, throw it away. Not any good anymore. Why do you want it around? Get rid of it. What else is a bruised reed good for? And how do you get people light? Well, they would take a bowl of oil and put a piece of flax in that and light it for a wick. What happened, though, when the oil was burned down and the wick began to flicker and create smoke in the house, it wasn't going to give them much bright light anymore. It was only dimly smoldering, so they would go snuff it out. That's what you do with a wick that's no good. That's what they would do, but that's not what God's servant does. How does the servant treat a person who's broken and discouraged and barely making it? How does the servant treat a person who's run out of resources like a dimly smoldering wick? He doesn't snuff it out. He just replenishes the oil till it can burn bright again. Now, we said in the context of Isaiah that Israel was the servant for now. However, as we go through Isaiah, we're going to find out that Israel's not up to this. They can't do the job. It's going to require a better servant than they've ever been or that they ever will be. Remember, Isaiah's whole point in this section is God is Lord and the nations and their idols are not. And God will use his chosen servant to do what he wants to do. Now, we see that dramatically affirmed in Matthew chapter 12. What Jesus did was to heal the sick, and then he didn't turn around running and crying out in the streets and calling attention to himself and getting all the newspaper reporters over and making sure the TV cameras were at hand. He said, "Don't tell anybody who I am." Matthew quotes this passage out of Isaiah and says, "Look, here's how you recognize the servant. He's not breaking the bruised reed, he's healing it. He's not quenching the dimly smoldering wick. He's fanning it back into flame. He's not crying out in the streets. He's going quietly about his work, showing people what the kingdom of God is like by the way that he lives. And more than that, Matthew said this servant was doing just exactly what God needed his servant to do. He was leading justice to victory and was giving the nations a name in which they could hope. Israel wasn't up to the task, and as we read through Isaiah, we'll find that God recognized that a long time ago. And so, finally, it's going to come down to one man who was up to the task. But this servant has a mission, and the mission is to help people see what it's like to live under the reign of God. They have a method, and that method is not to cry out in the streets and make a big hoopla. It's gentleness and concern that's going to draw in this bruised reed and not push him or her away. And if we understand this, then we understand a part of the Old Testament that most people miss. See, God rescued Israel, and he wants to rescue all nations. Back in Genesis 15, God said, by Abraham's seed, all nations would be blessed. And so we won't understand the Old Testament unless we understand two very important things. One is, God has a heart for all nations, and he always did. That didn't just start with the Great Commission. That started from the time he gave that promise to Abraham and even before. The other is the place that God intends for Israel to have in getting that message of God to all the nations. God's servant didn't just start having a responsibility to carry the message to the nations when Jesus gave the Great Commission. It started back when he appointed Israel as a servant to the nations. So twice again he says he'll bring justice. He'll bring faithfulness. He won't falter or be discouraged until he's established justice on the earth. That's normally the responsibility of a king, to establish justice in his realm. But the nations hadn't seen that kind of justice. The needy weren't going to get much justice. And so what the servant is going to do for the nations is to show them God and bring light to them so that they can see in the darkness and understand how to live. Now, if this servant won't break a bruised reed or put out a dimly smoldering wick, he must be pretty weak, right? How's he going to be up to this task of helping the nations come to see God? Well, God uses a wordplay to tell us. We won't see this translated in our English versions, but it's there in Hebrew. In verse 3, he may not put out a dimly smoldering wick, but it says in Hebrew in verse 4, he won't smolder. Those are the same two words. In verse 3, he may not break a bruised reed, but it says in verse 4, he won't be bruised himself. Again, those are the same words in Hebrew. The servant is going to respect the frail, but he's not frail himself. They may burn dimly and be bruised, but he won't. You see, he can't afford to be weak because he's got a mission. His purpose is to bring hope and justice to the world, and he's got to stay strong to stay focused on that mission. But that's the kind of servant that God delights in. That's how the servant will go about establishing justice for the nations. But now, if you're in Babylon, you've got to be thinking, God wants to deliver us. Yes! God has the power to save us. Yes! God wants us to be his servant to take justice to the nations. And you may have second thoughts there. God says to them, let me put this in some perspective. This is not just anyone who chose you to be a servant. I'm the one who created the heavens and stretched them out. I'm the one who spread out the earth. I'm the one who gives breath and life to everyone on the earth. And by the way, would you like to know how I called you? In righteousness. Isaiah's just not going to let us forget about justice and righteousness. Now, you don't think you can do what I called you to do because you're captives of the strongest nation on the face of the earth. He says, I'll take hold of your hand. I'll keep you. I'll make you a light to the Gentiles. Open your eyes and see what I'm calling you to. I'm calling you to open blind eyes. I'm calling you to free captives from prison. I'm calling you to release those who sit in the darkness of dungeons. I'm the Lord, and this is the direction we're going in. Now, when God speaks that way, it kind of gets our attention, doesn't it? Why is it that we go half a world away to take the gospel? Why is it we reach out to our neighbor across the street? Because God is Lord, and he's the one who wants to take care of blindness and darkness. God wants his servant to be a light to the nations. He wants us to open eyes that are too blind to see God and show them the power and mercy and love of the Father. He wants us to take people who are deep in this prison of sin and lead them out, and that's why God called his servant. And by the way, how are we doing about that? Who's saying to us, you're a light? This church really is a light in the darkness. Who's saying to a person, you know, being around you, being around this church is like freedom from prison? You know, they're just the kind of people that have that sort of compassion and that sort of message. But he also wants his servant to be a covenant to the people. Now, that's a pretty strange expression. You can make a covenant. How can you be a covenant to someone? Chances are, when you got up this morning, you never thought, I'm going to be a covenant to someone today. In fact, you might ask, how would you even do that? What does it mean? I think it means this. The very existence of this righteous remnant, this group who has experienced God's great deliverance, the very fact that they exist is a sign that God is keeping his word. You know, the rainbow in the sky is a sign that God keeps his word. When you see a rainbow, you say, what does that mean? And it gives you a chance to talk to somebody about God. Well, the righteous remnant serves the same function as the rainbow. You see the rainbow, you think God's covenant, never to destroy the world by water again. You see people who are trying to live under the reign of God, and you think God's covenant. He's doing exactly what he said he would do. He's trying to reach all nations. And every time you or I reach out to a neighbor as a light shining in the darkness, every time we stand up for goodness and righteousness, every time we take the gospel anywhere, it's a sign that God keeps his promises. So God is trying to help some very hopeless and discouraged people in Babylon realize that when He calls them home, it's not just a feel-good message. They're going home. But they're not going home just to sit around and say, well, man, it feels good to be home. They're going home because God has a mission for them. God has a purpose. And so His whole first point is that God is Lord, and the nations and their idols are not. So when God declares something, it's going to happen. The nations only had a pathetic response, build a bigger and better idol, and they couldn't. Israel's the chosen servant, so she needs to quit trusting in these idols that can't predict the future, explain history, or do anything at all. God can do something, and He is. He's already put in place, well over 100 years before Cyrus is even born, He's put in place the fact that history is going to change and His people will go home. And His servants can do something as well. They can be a light to the Gentiles. They can show the nations what it's like to live under God's rule, and they can call people to God by the way that they live. Now, very quickly, as we close out today, we're in a section of Isaiah that's known as the First Servant Song. Now, we see a concept that we'll see throughout Isaiah, and that's the word servant. And in this last part of Isaiah, we're going to see several servant songs, which are literally songs or poems about the servant of God. And if you read Hebrew, we'd see in them that they have a cadence or a rhythm much like a song would today. They're meant to be memorialized. They're meant to be reflected on. But how do we recognize poetry? Take as an example the NIV. We'll see that poetry in Hebrew in the Old Testament is shown in stanzas with indentions. And so if you happen to have a NIV or several other versions of the Bible that do the same thing, you can tell poetry by looking at it that way, whereas narrative is shown in paragraph form. So if you have a version that shows it this way, it's very plain if you're reading poetry or narrative. And these poems talk about someone called the servant, and that's the major theme of Isaiah 40 through 55. These servant songs are going to tell us some incredible things, but they also challenge us to understand them, because poetry is not always as clear as prose. You remember this incident back in chapter 8. The eunuch happened to be riding along in his chariot, and he was reading a servant song from the book of Isaiah. And finally he asked Philip, "Tell me, who is the prophet talking about, himself or somebody else?" Now, a lot of you who've been reading through Isaiah feel very much like the eunuch. I know this is good, but who's he talking about? And so we'll find out that the servant does not always refer to the same person as we go through Isaiah. Sometimes Isaiah changes from one definition to the other. Sometimes it's the nation of Israel. But the nation of Israel can't get the job done, so he narrows the servant down to what he calls this righteous remnant, this leftover from Israel that's still trying to hang on and do the right thing. And then finally, even that can't do it, and that righteous remnant, by the time we get to chapter 53, that powerful chapter in Isaiah, is going to be down to one man. As we go through, we need to ask ourselves the question, who is he talking about? Now, there are four servant songs in Isaiah, but we're not going to spend a lot of time getting caught up in the details of that, because scholars don't even agree exactly always as to which verses are included. The important thing is that we need to understand this concept of what it means to be a servant. The concept that God called Israel to be a servant because He wanted them to be a light to the nations. And then when He turned around and told His apostles, "Go into all the world, teach the gospel to all creation," doesn't that sound a whole lot like being a light to the nations? The nature and purpose of God's servant really hasn't changed over the years. We're here to show people who God is and reflect His glory, whether we do that across the world or whether we do that in our neighborhood or our school or our business. God is calling His servant to be a light to the nations. We'll pick up there next week with His second point. So for next week, read Isaiah chapters 42 through 45, and we'll pick up there next week.